Well, good evening, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing? We're almost there. I want to thank everybody for coming, and I think I've said this every time, that this is not a step study or how to do the steps or anything to replace your sponsor or anything. It is time to have some fun and tell some stories about AA, talk about some principles that are involved in our 12 steps, and talk about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and how AA is put together, and just share with you some of the thoughts I have on each of these aspects. Now, we just about wrapped up the history last week as far as the stuff that's in the history books. Obviously, we've been going through things over the last 15 or 20 years, but the historical figures have pretty well faded into the past. And the only two that are really left, well, they're not left, but that I haven't talked about, Bill didn't have any children. He and Lois tried, but they ended up not having any children. So there's no heirs over on that side. But over on Dr. Bob's side, he had two children, a daughter and a son. And the daughter, Sue, ended up running off to get married with one of the first guys to get sober in Akron, Ernie Galbraith, much to the chagrin of those around there. He was staying in their house. That is really taking advantage of your sponsor when you take off with his daughter. So we were doing outrageous things from day one, which is why sponsors don't look surprised when you tell them some outrageous thing, because it's already happened or they've done it. And I put down some notes on this. She eventually remarried her childhood sweetheart, and they had two sons. She passed away in 02, and it was survived by her two sons. Now, the two of them got together before they both died. Smitty was the son's name, and a lot of people around here may have met Smitty, because of all things, he ended up in Al-Anon, marrying an alcoholic. And so that brought him into the fellowship through a different door than his father was in. And the two of them collaborated on a book, The Children of, I'm forgetting the name of it, The Children of AA. And it's very interesting. Smitty talked about his own life, and he was a B-24 pilot in World War II and a very successful businessman. And remarried after his wife died, and a lot of us met his wife, and they weren't married but about a year when he died in 04. The interesting thing when I read that book was to watch the beginning of Sue's story, and she took almost the entire first page to let everybody know that Bill Wilson got too much credit compared to Dr. Bob. And it's funny how that Akron perspective on things continued. It just continued over the years. Henrietta Seiberling felt the same way, and anything that she wrote or was quoted on, it just made it clear that there was too much publicity that went to New York. And to this day, there's still the tension. I think we talked about it before, on the two approaches to AA, the New York and Akron. Now, what I want to talk about before I get to the principles on the 11th step, we have a triangle, you've seen it, the circle and the triangle, And then you know that it says recovery, unity, and service, which are the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we talked about the steps, which are recovery, and we talked about the traditions, which are unity, but we haven't really talked about the service side of Alcoholics Anonymous that much. So I'm going to take 15 minutes or so and give you my brief history and summary of that part of the triangle. Now, when you go back to the very beginning, Alcoholics Anonymous was pretty much run by Dr. Bob, Bill Wilson, and the Alcoholic Foundation Board. If you recall, Bill set up a foundation after Rockefeller wouldn't give him any money because he thought money would ruin AA. And Bill said, very interesting, but I want to raise money. So he got the foundation board and set out to use them to donate money to and to raise money. And from the very beginning, Bill wanted to make sure that there were more non-alcoholics on the board than alcoholics. And they hired a law firm to write the bylaws of the original board. And the lawyers had a very hard time figuring out how to put in the legal document what an alcoholic was. In other words, how do you explain being an alcoholic legally? So that they really wrestled with that. But they ended up with three non-alcoholics and two alcoholics. And one of the alcoholics on the board got drunk and had to be replaced. And so that started the thing that, well, we better keep the number of non-alcoholics in greater numbers than the alcoholics. And it became a sore spot with Bill as he felt AA matured and he wanted to change the majority over to the alcoholics. And that board was increased a couple of times, up to nine. And then in 1954, the foundation was over, and we created the General Service Board. And since that time, that has been the entity that is mainly in charge of our service. In 1955, it was a big thing for Bill and the old-timers, because at the St. Louis Convention, they wanted to, Bill knew that eventually AA had to govern itself. That all the drunks that are coming in had to be in charge of their own fellowship. Up till then, Bill and Dr. Bob, and they would run to Bill, what do we do about this? What do we do about that? But he knew he's going to die. Dr. Bob already had died. And so they had a formal passing on in 1955 of the three legacies over to the fellowship itself, and the General Service Conference became the conscience and director of the organization that you and I belong to. In 1962, the General Service Conference adopted Bill's manuscript on the 12 concepts, which give instructions to the delegates and the board as to what principles they should follow in managing the affairs of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the interesting thing is that that manuscript adopted by the General Service Conference is the only official publication in AA with a byline. In other words, by somebody, and it says by Bill W. Just a trivia thing for those of you who collect trivia out there. Now, until 1971, in spite of transferring everything over, we couldn't resist asking Bill's opinion on everything. You follow what I'm saying? He's still alive. and he's showing up. And he dropped in the office once in a while, but it was really difficult. And so finally in 1971, when he passed on, we started running our own show. In the back of the big book, just about the last page, are the 12 concepts. And they basically describe where the authority in the fellowship is. They talk to the fact that the GSC is our voice and conscience. And then they establish certain rights. The right to make decisions, the right of appeal, and the right to participate. And that means we all get to participate as much as we want. And when decisions are made, they can be appealed. And so it's a very important thing. And the final one, these are not all of them, but I'm trying to give you a feel for what they are. It is a principle that never should power be centralized in one little group or one person or anything like that. And so that's a very important one of our concepts. So right now, what is managing our affairs are 21 trustees, and Bill was able in 1966 to get the majority of the trustees to be alcoholic. And now there's 14 alcoholics and 7 non-alcoholics that constitute our board of trustees. In addition to them, we have 93 delegates from U.S. and Canada in 93 areas in those two countries. And so we have a delegate from our area, and the way it operates is, if problems are coming up, and we want to make sure New York and the annual General Service Conference hears about them and deals with them, or at least thinks about them, this is how it's done. We have our intergroup representative, and we pass on, and we attend meetings and find out what's going on in other groups. And you'll see when we get into some of the issues that AA service has had to deal with, that this is really important to participate in this. We also have the General Service Conference, and we have the employees in the New York office. And there's 11 employees in that office, and each one of them, if you've ever been up there, they each have an office, and they have a specific area of responsibility, like literature, setting up a conference, for dealing with people overseas, dealing with the professionals, dealing with prisons and jails. And in the absolute tradition of AA, every 2 years, they pick up all their crap and move over to the office next to them and take over the responsibility. So like, well, I was in prison, but now I'm in literature. So that nobody gets to be, I'm in charge. And with that expertise, if something happens to one of them, there are other people there that know how that job is done while they break in somebody new. So it's a fascinating thing of New York, and they just switched offices last month. So if you'd been up there, you would have seen moving day, and you take all your stuff to the office next door. The delegates have a term of 2 years. The trustees have a term of 4 years. And as I said, the GSO staff rotates every 2 years. Now, I did some research and looked at some of the issues, just so you know what has come up. And these are some that I decided to take a look at. One of them was reaching out. In other words, part of AA's job is to carry the message to other alcoholics. And the first example of reaching out goes all the way back to the very, very beginning, when Catholics were having a hard time joining Alcoholics Anonymous. You remember that story way back in Akron? And they came down from Cleveland, and the church said, well, if you keep going to the Oxford group, we're going to excommunicate you. And Clarence decided to start a meeting outside and not call it the Oxford group, and they were able to be accommodated. And since that time, They have made special efforts to reach out to blacks, women, Hispanics, handicapped, including illiterate. In other words, that became a thing. How do we help an illiterate person who can't even read our literature? What can we do to help that alcoholic stay sober? Pamphlets for gays, Indians, young, old. I can't believe they wrote a pamphlet for old. I don't think we... I don't feel I need any help. They're not talking about me. They're talking about old alcoholics that can't believe that they have the problem, and getting them to surrender and try AA is very difficult. The military, and those in jails and prisons. So that was kind of give you an example of reaching out. And so they would have meetings they'd come up with. This seems like a good idea. This is how we can go to jails. This is, and so you know, our institutions committees. And this is the kind of stuff that gets deliberated. The next thing was the professionals. Now, we didn't have to worry about professionals until the 70s when federal laws were passed making alcoholism a disease. That didn't bring the professionals in. It's when it was covered by insurance. That brought the professionals in because now you could make money treating drunks. Up till then, you didn't want them in your office. They never paid their bills. And who wants to help them? But now with insurance coverage, so now we have other people advising new alcoholics on how to stay sober. Sometimes in conflict to what they hear when they eventually get to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so we had an outreach program so that AA could go and talk to professionals and make them more aware of what AA is doing. And we ran into the treatment centers that, geez, the best counselors would be AA members. And when that first happened, I don't know if some of you were around then, it was, oh, he's a two-hatter. That was the term that was being used. He's a traitor to carrying the message for nothing. You follow what I'm saying? He's being paid to carry that message. And they finally resolved it, that he wasn't 12-stepping and carrying the message. He was helping the person get through detox and educate them about the disease and get them ready to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that finally the two-hatter thing, and now many of us work in the treatment facilities with no problem whatsoever and no stigma attached or any of that. We ran into the first time judges started sending people to AA. I mean, I couldn't believe it. The guy came in with a sheet of paper. I mean, when it's the first sheet of paper you've ever seen at an AA meeting, you go, we don't sign papers. We've never signed one before, and I'm not starting tonight. I mean, I think I'm capturing the essence of every AA group. We don't do it that way. And so we had to go through the process of educating all the AA groups and talking with judges, and things have smoothed out, and now it's not a major event. Then we have the treatment centers taking people through the steps in treatment, and then they come out, and now they got a sponsor, and they go, oh, no, the treatment center, that's not the way to do that at all. So we had to work on those types of problems. Then we had conflicting advice to newcomers, pills, and outside experts. The earliest one I remember was the RAND report from the RAND think tank up in Washington, and they concluded that AA didn't know what they were doing, that we really ought to be taking alcoholics and teaching them how to drink. And so we had to respond to these various things. And I remember the Sobels were two psychologists from Canada, and they had... All of a sudden, it hit the thing. We have been treating alcoholics for years with our aversion therapy, and we have hundreds that are staying sober. And this was the only time when there was great big numbers. And everybody went, wow, this is a really, we have to, what is that? What is that? And it stayed that way for a number of years until two more psychologists studied the follow-up. Nobody was sober. It turns out they were doing their research by calling the alcoholic, asking him how he was doing. I'm doing great. Okay, we got another. We have another success down there in Utah. Okay, then we went through the types of groups. And this is within AA itself. People started identifying by women. Well, let's start a women's group, or a men's group, or a gays group. It had nothing to do with having a different disease. It is just that we find comfort in getting people who are similar to us. And we've used that with women, gay, black, old, young, pilots, lawyers, and doctors. And I find them very useful when you're new. But then it's time to get into mainstream AA, where there's one of everything in the room, and not all around the table looks just like you, because all you get is the same perspective that you have. And there's nothing like an old housewife to tell a Marine colonel he's full of crap. At a military meeting. You follow what I'm saying? Well, you may fly the plane well, but you're stupid. So, then we have a thing called meetings. So if a treatment center wants to offer a meeting-type situation, sometimes we call that a meeting. And we take a meeting to a treatment center so that the people in there can hear what a meeting looks like, and they can get sponsors and so on down. But it's not a group. Nobody belongs to it. You follow what I'm saying? The other thing was the dual purpose meetings. And those started up as we got an increase in dual addiction. And people said, you know, I'd be more comfortable just meeting with other people who are dually addicted. And those groups started up, but the General Service Conference took a look at that and said, great, I hope it helps you, but we're not going to list you as an AA group. That is not AA. And so that type of dual purpose, it was felt, and very wisely, that it would start broadening AA and weaken the identification that is so necessary, and we talked about before. And the last thing they said there's still a problem, and we've never really been able to completely address it, of drug addicts who choose to attend closed AA meetings in spite of knowing what the traditions are, because there's nobody in charge. You can't not allow that. You see what I'm saying? There's no rules in AA. And so that continues to be a problem across the country. Okay, the last item was finances, self-supporting. And, of course, they declined outside contributions from the very beginning, even though it was contrary to what Bill's plan was. And they tried to make AA self-supporting, meaning from you and I. You know what I mean? In 1964, when I came in, they passed the word that the General Service Office could function if every member of AA would donate $1 a year. And they didn't get it. They had to get some of the income from big book sales. So think about that. $1 a year? And so when they ask at groups, could you increase, that's what they're talking about. They're trying to make us self-supporting off of us, and not off of selling books. And so as we got more successful, and the big book, 1 million, 5 million, suddenly people, non-members of AA, are buying more literature than AA members, and our income, if you really get technical on that particular situation, is coming from outsiders. It wasn't a member buying a big book. It was a treatment center and libraries or wherever they're going. So that became more urgency in upping the ante that comes from you and me. And we still I would say the average donation at an AA meeting for all the coffee you can drink and all the spiritual advice you can get and the wonderful fellowship and camaraderie, the average donation is about one-fourth of what it costs for a cup of coffee at Starbucks. And so when they ask, could we put a little more in, don't be embarrassed to put $2 in. That's all I'm saying. I'm trying to share where they are. Bill had this saying when I was new. He said, drunks will buy the bar around the drinks when they're drinking. They'll set up Madison Square Garden. When they get sober, they're tight as the bark on a tree. And that was his quote. Anyway, the individual limit went from 100 to 1,000. Lois wanted to donate stepping stones. They turned it down. Said, no, we're not going to take that and own it and get the income off of that. So it became a state historical place. And the last thing on that is our magazine, The Grapevine. Now, The Grapevine, I think we talked about it, started out as a little tiny newsletter, and it became one of the great magazines where people could contribute stories and share their experiences in AA. And it was a very powerful thing. A man outside of Chicago just celebrated his 60th anniversary, and I sent him a card. His name is Paul M. And I used to wait for The Grapevine that would have a Paul M. story in it, where he's going to discuss some principle in AA. I mean, he was such a good writer. And it really was exciting. And this is a general feeling across the fellowship that as the years have gone on, while Grapevine became more diverse, it backed off on really focusing on God. The God banner just seemed less than it used to be. And it was more a reflection that perhaps that's the culture that we're in. The country doesn't want to hear that much about God, so we won't put it in there that it might offend somebody. Now, that's just a few people's opinion. I'm sure there's other ways of looking at this. But that's the last thing that I was going to talk about in terms of the structure of AA, the history, and all of that. So now we're just left with the 11th step and then a total wrap-up next week about the whole deal and just some stories, and I hope it becomes a real fun wrap-up meeting. So we're on this step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Quite a mouthful. And at some point in telling stories, I told you about one of my heroes, Chuck Chamberlain, and his assessment as he got older. And his assessment was, and I think I talked about it earlier, there's only one, this is for all human beings, there's only one problem, and that includes all problems. And there's only one solution, and that includes all solutions. The problem is conscious separation from God. Our awareness, before we get working on these steps, tells us that we exist separate from God. That God is something over there, and then there's us. And I think I told you my reaction to God is everything or He's nothing. I said, well, I guess He is everything. I'm just going to imagine Him. He's everything. He's the story. He's all these people. He's all that. And part of me went, yep, and then there's you. I don't know if you relate to that, but it was like, Yeah? But I'm over here. I'm not in the big circle of everything. I'm over here. And that's what conscious separation is. And it exists because of our story. We put together all the slides and there's God isn't in them. So whenever we look at the world that we created, there's just me at the center. Just like in a dream. I'm done. Never did I have a dream I wasn't in. And so we become the center of our own lives, which causes terrible problems because it's us against them. It's, I'm the only one I can rely on. I have to be strong. I have to do this, and the world is unfair. And it's so overpowering, and it's all caused by conscious separation. What does the 11th step say? Sought to improve our conscious contact. Ah! No more separation. Conscious contact. Now, we're in touch with a different world. And there's a saying, instead of being apart from, we're a part of. And it's a little play on words, but it's very powerful. Instead of living apart from everything, I come over and become part of something. And that begins with starting to be part of AA. And you like it. And we go, I'm really part of AA. It was the only thing I was a part of. And then I worked the steps and went through the changing of the old ideas. We've been using slides. And as I did that, the picture on the screen started changing and it became apparent that the Creator was the center. I'm just one of the guys on the bus. And it took a lot of pressure off. I wasn't in charge of anything. I'm just supposed to show up, have a cup of coffee, listen to the speaker, and enjoy it. My top job is enjoy life. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. And so we start in on this, and of course the ego has not given up. We've made a lot of progress in squashing that guy down, erasing different old ideas. And he sees this thing about prayer and meditation. And he immediately comes up, I don't know about you all, but as soon as somebody said prayer and meditation, I said, that doesn't work. I never tried it. But I said, it doesn't work. Therefore, why should I try something that doesn't work? And Bill uses a sentence in the 12 and 12 that I've always loved. He said, we are the same as a scientist who refuses to perform a certain experiment lest it prove his pet theory wrong. And part of us doesn't want to try prayer and meditation out of fear that it might work and make us look like a jerk. Hey, I've been wrong all these years. This stuff really works. Now, isn't that silly that we would cut off our nose to spite our face and not give this a fair shake? And so all of this is designed to further erase our old ideas and move closer to the light so that that's what's shining through. The other part of the thing I wanted to talk about was praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Now, many people, when they see that, they go, well, I'd like to do that, but I also want to pray for my uncle. And I want to pray for world peace. And I want to pray for the starving people over there. And I want to pray for this, and I want to pray for that. And there's all these causes that we want to pray for. And yet the steps suggest praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. It turns out this is a remarkable change in the traditional way of looking at prayer. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. The purpose of the whole program is to have an awakening. To have an awakening. If we go back to Varieties of Religious Experience, the author of that book said the greatest contribution that has ever been made to the human race are awakened people. That contributes more to the world than anything. It is a much higher goal than a limited target. A limited target, how is the target chosen that I'm going to pray for? By my ego. I think this ought to be different. And so I want this person to get well. Well, maybe they're not supposed to get well. Maybe they're supposed to learn some lessons from further sickness. In other words, we aren't in charge of everything. And so Bill makes this point over and over that when we're doing that, we are simply looking at the big screen and deciding what's wrong and praying that it be changed. And we're back working up there instead of in here. It may sound unkind, but it really isn't. Of course we want all these things to turn out a certain way. But the best way we can contribute to all of that is to allow more light to come through us. That's the greatest contribution that we can make. And so that's why he comes up with praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. So if we focus on that, and we're back in our slide booth, working only on the slides in there, and not keeping track of what's going on in the world, because we want to change the world that we're living in, this is where we work. And we're working on getting, we have a collection of, God, I suppose the average person has 10 or 15,000 slides. We got opinions on everything. And we got memories of experiences, and each day we look around going, wrong, right, wrong, wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, yeah, that shouldn't happen, this is that, I hate that, this is wrong. I mean, there's probably 1,000 a day, and we don't even know it. And it causes us a great deal of pain, and so we're going to go, I'm going to stop fixing the screen, I'm going to stay in here. And that's when we inventory, and we start bringing them up to get them erased, to get them so that only light shines through. And that's a long-term project. But as the results come in, it looks something like the prayer of St. Francis, where we reach in and we take out the hatred slide and we allow the program to erase it and are focusing on our higher power, and what shines through is love. It came out of us. This is what is inside of us. When you look at the prayer of St. Francis, he is describing this. Ooh, that's going to sound good. Chris, why'd you bump into the microphone? He is describing the powers that are inside of us and what happens when the barriers to them are released. He is describing you. This is who you really are. Your essence is love. hatred is what we got by watching this stuff. I hate that. I hate that. But that isn't who you are. That's the story that we create. Well, you got to hate that guy. And when that thing's erased, that hatred slide, love comes through. And that's what his whole prayer is about. Where there's hatred, I bring love. That where there is wrong, remember we look at all the wrong in the world? Look at that's wrong. That's wrong. You're wrong. You wronged me. And then we clear this off, and what comes out is forgiveness. Just that comes out naturally. Oh, somebody wronged me. Well, they're probably messed up. I'm pray for them. That's fine. It's a whole different thing. You can see we're so free as these events are happening. Everything's screwed up. Absolute discord. When we work on that, harmony comes out. This is what is inside already. This isn't anything that we learn. This is not, it's there. This is the true nature of our spiritual selves. And so we're not learning how to be loving. We are. It's just been blocked by this stuff we've been creating up there. Where there's error, we bring truth. Truth comes intuitively. It suddenly is revealed. We didn't figure it out. We didn't study it in the book. We didn't do anything. We just got error washed and washed. And what was left was truth coming out. So where there is doubt, do you doubt all the time? And if we get that to disappear, faith automatically appears. We already have it. You see how different a view of everything this is. The way there is despair. Oh my God, it's the end of the world. Alright, well we don't want to play that one anymore. Let's just wipe it. Oh my God. Hope. Hope springs eternal. It's just out it comes. It's already there. That's the wonderful gift that we're getting here, is the awareness of what's already inside if we do this work. That where there are shadows, I may bring light. So there's the light. We don't go get it and bring it. It shines. You watch people in this program as they go through and follow, they're going, yeah, my sponsor wants me to do this. And I can't believe he wants me to go to New York and make a freaking amends. And then they start glowing because they went up there and erased an old hatred slide. And you start seeing them at meetings and you just go, God, you're always happy. You're just going, where was I? Shadows. And finally, where there's sadness, I bring joy. Bill said the whole theme of AA is the joy of living. What does that mean? It means we're going to open it so that that's you. Why do people become joyful? Because they got sadness out of the way. I mean, it's such a different way of looking at all of this. And St. Francis went through hell to get to this point where his awareness showed all of this. And I think we talked about it earlier about the life of St. Francis. When you see a picture of him, birds are sitting on his shoulder and deer coming out of the woods just to stand near him. What is that? I would say in AA vernacular, that is a program of attraction. That people aren't, you know, you don't come in here and get beaten to do these things. You go, that really happens? Does that really happen? And then we see it happening in people. That is called a program of attraction. And then he goes on, it is by self-forgetting that one finds. So the way to really take care of yourself is to not take care of yourself. It's just, I'm just going to leave that go. And then everything is revealed to us. And It is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is by dying that one awakens to life eternal. What does dying mean? Clean slides. It's almost, you're walking around without a past. Man without a country. Man without a past. I can't even remember what I used to resent. How would that be? What's your biggest resentment? God damn, I can't even remember. Where'd it go? Somebody blotted it out. God damn, I wish I kept the record. I can't remember. What a different way of looking at all of this. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve this contact that began at the end of the promises when we said we suddenly realized that God is doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. The awareness was personal. It wasn't a theory. It wasn't, well, God's real to me because other people tell me about it. No, that's not real. That's just book knowledge. What we want, in order for this to really work, is for us to go, holy cow, I felt it myself. You mean this spiritual stuff is works? I remember the couple of young people up in Washington, D.C., and one of them was trying to explain it. They were probably 18 or 19. Now they're much younger. Maybe they were 20. Seemed real young to me. And one of them was trying to talk his buddy, who was brand new, into the program. And he summed it all up by looking him right in the eye, and he said, "This spiritual crap works." And you know something? That's the language of the heart. And I think his buddy went, "It does?" Because he said, "This is what I thought it was before it changed me. I thought it was spiritual crap." And it stays that way until we do it. And then we start having this experience sought to improve our conscious context. So for our story purposes, improving is getting another slide erased. Getting another one erased. Now the more that we do that, the more, remember the problems that we want to help, we will intuitively know how to handle things. We will bring an awareness and a knowledge to the situation that we didn't have before, and we're going to contribute much more to every situation than we did in the past. And none of it's going to happen by learning anything. It's all going to happen by erasing what we know. Isn't that ironic? Oh, you know all about that? Come here. Now you don't. Now, we're not talking about knowledge about how to work a computer or how to do your job. We're talking about how the world works. Your personal story about the world. Your editorializing. That's what we're talking about here, because that is where all our problems are. As we said earlier, our problems are of our own making. Who made all these lousy slides? Oh, I did. Yeah, everyone in there, I made. And I made it by thinking. That's how we create them. I'm going to think about this. Come to think of it, that was really bad what that guy did. As a matter of fact, the more I think about it, it's outrageous what he did. I'm going to think about it all night. I'm going to move it up to kill him. That's how you create slides. So thinking has to be out. And that's where prayer and meditation. We're trying to go into a state where thinking is sitting on the outside, not screwing everything up. Thinking is the ego saying, "That prayer and meditation isn't going to work. You don't want to try that. You look silly." What if somebody came in the room and you got your eyes closed? They go, "Look at Larry." That's the ego trying to talk us out of doing this. Dad, you look bad. You look bad. Whatever it is. It's not going to work. Remember, you tried it once when you were 15. You went, help, help, nothing happened. That's enough proof for me. We're just about ready to wrap up, but I will say that as I inventoried my ideas to get rid of, the ones that most of them were put together by the time I was 15, and I'm 40. They govern my life, and I'm reluctant to get rid of them, even though they produce terrible results. Well, look, this, you keep doing that, you're always going to get this, and you feel sick, and you do. I know, but it's me. It's the real me. I hate to. That is the pride to hold on to the way you thought things should be or are. Your evaluation of the situation. The hardest thing for self-centered people to give up is their judgment about things. I'll decide what this whole situation looks like. And when we give that up and go through this process, we see what the situation looks like from God's perspective. And it's entirely different than from self-centered me. So I'll leave that with you. We're at the end of the time. I appreciate your attention. And I hope you come back next week for the wrap-up. And we'll close with the Lord's Prayer for anybody who cares to join me.